You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Latinos are the biggest and fastest growing ethnic group in the United States, but how much of what we hear or read about this diverse community is fact and how much is fiction? Arlene Davila, professor of anthropology and American studies at New York University, examines Latinos' supposed values, political attitudes, and shifting roles in her latest book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. It's published by New York University Press, and I'm delighted that it brings Arlene Davila to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
You've said that the Latino community is caught between wildly contrasting characterizations in our country. They're either depicted as illegal immigrants, tax burdens, and job stealers, or patriots, family-oriented, and hard workers. Why such contradictory images?
That's one of the things that I try to explore is why those contrasting images and why they circulate in tandem, right? Which is what's even more curious and more intriguing is not that there's either or, but that they're at the same time simultaneous.
Is it because we're talking about so many different Latino communities and we're trying to lump them all together?
Oh, absolutely. And because there's so many different interests and agendas that profit from and that benefit from either or of these contrasting images.
Your title is Latino Spin. The subtitle is Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. I want to talk about spin and whitewashing. Where does the spin come from and who benefits from it?
Yeah, this with the word spin, I'm trying to really call attention to not so much the knowledges and the representations that are created, but also how the dominance of some representation over others, the fact that there's this kind of manufactured kind of I don't want to say fake entirely, but because, you know, all of the surveys and reports and representations, they have a foundation. But I'm more interested and intrigued in exploring what accounts for the dominance of some representations over others.
Is the Latino community more susceptible to spin than other minorities?
I think all minorities are susceptible to spin, absolutely.
Well, we call it stereotyping, don't we?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. It's a reduction of representations, you know, to something that we could work from, that we could market, that we could sell, that we could use more easily, right? It's a reduction of complexity, right? I think Latinos have become a particularly profitable constituency, especially after the 2000 census, show that they had become the largest minority in this country. And also as a result of all the growing debates about what does this mean, how will Latinos affect the makeup of America's national identity. I think that since the 2000 census, we have really seen a plethora of these very reductive representations.
It's surprising because we're talking about the country's largest minority, and yet as big as it is, to some degree, invisible in its complexity.
Absolutely, yes. That's the main point of the book.
And what do you mean by whitewashing?
By whitewashing, great, yes. That's actually, I was very intrigued because we were very familiar with the negative portrayals of Latinos, right? The kind of poor, crime-ridden, undocumented, the kind of negative portrayals of Latinos, we're sort of familiar with that and we take them for granted that they exist, that they're in circulation and they're produced. But then there's another side, which is the other, positive, right? Latinos as model minorities, Latinos as conservatives, as family-driven, as good consumers, Latinos as traditional, and all of that other kind of positive, hardworking, right? So there's this other positive spin that has been in circulation, oftentimes in response, right, to the negative portrayals that have not really been questioned. And one of the arguments that I try to make is that I see an ascendancy in the more kind of positive, marketable, sanitized representations that have become more commonly circulated, oftentimes by advocates, by pundits, by people trying to sort of oftentimes respond to America's fears that, you know, there's nothing to be wrong with Latinos. Yes, they're the largest minority, but they're actually good for America. They're more American than the Americans.
And they
right?
pay their taxes, et cetera. But you contend that even the term Latino whitewashes the group. So what would you have preferred? Because you use Latino, Latinidad, and Hispanic throughout the book. And I'm not sure whether you're not using them interchangeably.
Absolutely, and I make that aside when I qualify my use of Latinos, and not use the gender neutral Latino, Latina, or you know, now people are using the nice kind of Latino with the asterisk, or to sort of because that's to sort of highlight and point to the spaces and the ways in which that Latino kind of homogeneous identity is being deployed. And I should say that, you know, when I was thinking the way that the show was represented, you know, how Latinos are unfairly generalized into a category, I was thinking, well, you know, yes, they are unfairly categorized, like any group is categorized. And I'm not saying that we should stop doing that, because I'm not saying that there's not something real and objective that we can talk about in regards to Latino populations in this country. There's something, whether it be the common historical legacy, the ways in which we tend to stereotype and associate Latinos with particular, in particular ways. I think that there's Latinos are living in a socially imagined community that absolutely needs to be brought into public attention.
Well, what would be the alternative to just split things up to Cuban American, Puerto Rican, Mexican American, Spanish American? We could go on and on and on and break it up. But the only thing that they have in common is the Spanish language. And even then, if you put two people together, somebody from Argentina and somebody from Cuba, they know right away that they have nothing in common, not even language.
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to do is get to the point. I mean, I think that we've gotten to the point that we're very sophisticated, you know, to sort of say that, yes, it's Latinos, you know, are very diverse. We can that construct be supported anymore, right? And there are people who want to do away with the category altogether because it doesn't make sense anymore. I think that what we need to do instead is really be more careful in our use and deployment of that category so that we can be aware of some of the exclusions that are reproduced when we use it. Oftentimes we sort of say, oh, this is a Latino exhibit, or this is a Latino show, or this is, and without, we don't really question whether or not Latinos are involved as producers, as stakeholders of those initiatives, or whether or not they are actually excluded and marginalized at the same time that we're claiming Latino representativity, right?
Well, we're talking about 40 million people. That's incredible growth, isn't it? What were the numbers 8 years ago, for example, when George W. Bush first ran for president?
You mean of Latinos,
yeah,
in the demographics?
It was way under 40 million, wasn't it?
God, I don't.
Well, but it is a very fast-growing group, and you have a chapter in your book called Latinos, the New Republicans. How are Latinos and New Republicans? Didn't the Latino vote go for Obama 67%?
Yeah, well, that's a very good example of the Latino spin, right? It's that generalization that was very much circulated among the political pundits that I was interviewing. This notion that, and actually that phrase comes from Reagan, who was the first president who actually hired and, you know, dealt with this kind of marketing, advertising, and basically, you know, there was a sense that Latinos are Democrats, and how could you convert them into Republicans? And this notion, well, you know, Latinos are Republicans, they just don't know it because they have these traditional values and family and all of that. These kinds of stereotypes of that the Republican Party has actually been targeting Latinos with that same kind of tagline since then, right? But that chapter, I think I went back to the 2004 because it's a very good example of how Latinos as a constituency were so reduced to these kinds of characterizations that we have seen were really constructions, because absolutely Latinos voted 2-1 for Obama. But even prior to the major election, there was a lot of fear. A lot of people felt that Latinos would not vote for a black president because that was yet another generalization that had been circulated.
But Rosie Perez told me she went down to Miami to talk to Hispanic voters. And some of them said, I can't vote for him, he's black. And Rosie said to them, but you're black. And they said, no, not I'm white.
Yeah, Latinos and race, that's a new one. That's another of the arguments that scholars and advocates have embraced to argue that Latinos are just like any other minority, that they are going to join the ranks of white mainstream culture. Because in fact, when you looked at the last census, 48% of Latinos marked white, right, and self-identified as white, and then 46% as some other race. It's important to know that Latinos voted, most Latinos voted as some other race than any other group in society. So some people argue that it's not really a process of whitening, but actually of Latinization that you see with those responses. Whether
when they said some other race, they were thinking Latino, not
Latino
black.
Or any other categorization. But this argument that Latinos are white because they self-identify as white is a very spurious categorization. That notion that how you self-identify actually exempts you from racism, right? We know that doesn't quite work.
My guest is Arlene Davila. Her book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, published by New York University Press. Well, one of the big issues in Albany at this time is the relative exclusion of Latino politicians from leadership positions in the Democratic Party. But part of the problems were that the politicians who were fighting, who said they might actually join the Republican Party, took rather conservative positions on issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, which they objected to the rest of the Democratic Party for having different opinions. So there is that whole thing on family values and the like that Ronald Reagan was right about, wasn't he?
Well, when you look at the political polls, you know, what they show is that where Latinos may have greater opposition to abortion, for instance, right? Or they also have more pro-immigrant immigration, pro-immigrant values, and they also have more pro-big government and social services. So this notion that their opposition to abortion, right, reduces them to being conservative is yet another good example of the kind of political spin that is created.
Well, I guess it's the Thomas Frank approach, where people sometimes vote for their values over their economic interests. You're saying that in the case of the Latino community on the whole, it's economic interest that comes first, whereas in Kansas it may be family values that comes first.
I should go back to clarify that the chapter on the Republican Party and looking at the 2004 election, what I actually do is show that Latinos actually didn't vote Republican. Latinos vote, you had a greater percentage of Latinos voting Republican, but as a group they voted Democratic. What was interesting is how the fact that more Latinos voted Republican became spinned as the fact that Latinos were now a sure base for the Republican Party. And if you look at all the coverage of the 2004 election, there were incredible generalizations being made about a greater percentage of Latinos voting Republicans that in fact were not supported by the data. And that's exactly the point that I want to make in that chapter.
One of the bigger surprises is that with this large minority group, we see so few people actually in public office.
That's a very good point. There's a lot of excitement right now about the three Latinos that have been chosen to be part of Obama's candidate. And it's important that we don't lose sight that absolutely, in terms of the numbers, Latino representation at all levels of government, both local, state, and national, lags really greatly behind. And this is a point that the National Association of Latino Elected Positions have made over and over, that not only are Latinos less likely to be elected, but that they're oftentimes either appointed or else concentrated in the lower rungs of government where they have less ability to actually affect change.
Do Latinos recognize Bill Richardson as a Latino politician?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when there's so few of us,
at
you know.
At least one name could have been have some kind of Spanish sound to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, you know, when there's so few, you know, you begin to grab into anything, you know.
My guest is Arlene Davila, D-A-V-I-L-A, professor of anthropology and American studies at NYU. Her previous books include Barrio Dreams, Puerto Ricans, Latinos, and the Neoliberal City, and Latinos Incorporated, Marketing and the Making of a People. The most recent one, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, published by New York University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Arlene Davila, professor of anthropology and American studies at NYU. Her latest book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, published by New York University Press. A lot has been written about the success of the Latino community. Is the Latino community as successful as we are being led to believe, or is this another example of the spin?
One of the great things that I was trying to expose is absolutely there's a growing acknowledgement of the diversity of the Latino population, that, you know, you can't just, there's, you know, middle-class Latinos, upper-middle-class Latinos, and, you know, and there's an incredible diversity.
Can't that be said about every minority group in America?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we could talk about Chinese American diversity, but there are an awful lot of poor Chinese Americans.
But what we see more of is this kind of this paradigm, and I talk about this paradigm shift, where we used to only talk about dysfunctions, and now we're only talking about successful Latinos and this kind of glitzy and glamorous and successful images that have sort of normalized, naturalized this idea that Latinos are moving up, that they're actually the next Italian Americans, like many pundits would like to believe, and that they're actually that's what I'm a lot of it I say in the book is. It's more a creation than a reality. It's generalizing a reality that fits some but not all segments of the Latino population.
But isn't this to some degree an attempt to correct the other image, which is of the Mexican American sneaking across the desert with a coyote, or the gangbangers of Los Angeles, or the gangs in Chicago?
Absolutely. And I should say that this tendency to correct Latino images has been the guiding force behind all social advocacy for Latinos since the 1900s.
And who's doing it? Is it coming out of the Latino community, or is it coming out of the other communities that are trying to woo Latinos as consumers and as voters?
Well, there's one chapter where I look at the changes in social advocacy, and I think it's really relevant when we look at, for instance, groups like the National Association of La Raza or NALEO, or all of these groups that have been really at the lead of formulating this kind of corrected image. And what the problem with that I say is this has been an ongoing trend. You know, we're not liabilities. We're not going to hurt you. We're going to be more American, as I said, than you, the regular Americans. We're going to refurbish. You don't need to be scared of us. And I think that the problem
in
with
fact, people say Latinos are more American than Americans. So, that's the latest line I've been hearing.
So is that compensatory line that I think that sanitizes Latinos and really limits their ability to be understood as a complex population? And also it limits our ability to really address issues of social equity and education and lags, and allows many pundits to use Latinos to co-opt them to support policies that hurt all Americans, for that matter.
But there also are a lot of people who are opposed to bilingual education, and that is directed at Latinos. Is that separated from what you're talking about?
Well, in the before we turn to, because bilingual education is yet another kind of worms, I want to specify that what makes problematic, I mean, I think we all like good stories of upward mobility, and we need to acknowledge that this is happening in the Latino community, that we're not a monolith. I think what I really want to highlight is how these stories of glitzy, sanitized, more marketable images become so mainstreamed and so generalizable. In ways, in the present context, we have to realize that there's a political climate in which these images are being circulated. And in particularly, we have the rise of color blindness as the dominant post-civil rights discourse on race. And nowadays, you know, poverty is out and you have to be entrepreneurial and you have to be moving up. And, you know, you have to prove your marketability and worthiness as a constituency, as a consumer, as a political group in order for you to count in society, in order for you to belong. So I connect that trend to make Latinos look good to that larger trend in our society where we have very few spaces to really think about social equity and needs. And that's one of my biggest concerns.
How does the Latino experience compare with the African-American experience? Is there a relationship between the two, other than what we discussed earlier, where many Latinos mm-hmm. will deny that they even have African roots?
Well, one of the guiding motivations for me writing this book was because I was very concerned in the way in which a lot of these Latinos as modern minority discourse was oftentimes used to against African Americans, to pit one group against the other, and to distance Latinos from African Americans. And one of the things that we've seen since the 2004 census is the growing circulation of these stories of Black and Latino divides and Black and Latino against each other that actually have paralleled the rise of all of these other, you know, Latinos as, you know, model minorities and good marketers and good political swing constituencies and all of that. And I wanted to make that connection between that because absolutely, the biggest concern is how they're also how this spin is actually tapping and mainstreaming Latinos in ways that is not only competing populations not necessarily against each other, but also the linking and making alliances more difficult, not only with African Americans, but also with Latinos themselves across lines of citizenship, class, and race.
I've thought about how people live together or apart as it relates to race and also to language. There are, even though New York is one of the least segregated cities in the country, we have a lot of segregation. There are areas you can go through where you do not see a white face. And there are areas you can go through where you do not see anybody who doesn't speak Spanish as a first language. In fact, there are neighborhoods where people don't ever have to learn to speak English because everybody speaks Spanish. But there's a big difference between the two. People may choose to live in that neighborhood because they're comfortable about the language. I'm not sure that all the black people who live in those neighborhoods where there are no white people are choosing to live there for any reason other than the fact that that's where the only place they can live.
Mm. Well, I think that one of the most exciting things and one of the things that I try to do in the book is not only look at the construction of spin of Latinos by marketers, by political pundits, and by think tanks, right? But also looking at how our communities, Latino communities, on the ground, working through those stereotypes. And a lot of my research is based in East Harlem, where we have Black and Puerto Ricans living with each other for, you know, historically, you know, and now Mexicans primarily too. So it's a very intra-ethnic and racial community and a lot of diversity. And what I try to do in the chapters that look at more the kind of living experiences of Latinos is really is give a sense of how on the ground, I mean, there's all of this spin about Black and Latinos, you know, at each other's throats. And what I saw and what I try to document is communities really facing the same obstacles, the same challenges, the same lagging infrastructure, the same lacks in education, in resources, being discriminated very similarly. And they're not oftentimes, you know, when developers come to these communities, they're not seen as Black and Puerto Rican. They're just seen as, you know, color folk, you know, people that are in their way for a glitzier, more luxury city. And it is as such that these communities come together. And I wanted to sort of, because that doesn't reach the mainstream, it doesn't reach the spin, right? Because it's not sexy and it's not worthy to say, oh, well, you know, Black and Latinos and Puerto Ricans are getting together against this and that proposal. That doesn't make the news ever. And it was important to know that is also part of the reality.
My guest is Arlene Davila. Her book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, is published by New York University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You talk about the Uptown New York Project in your book. Where does that stand these days?
Well, the last I heard is that they were one of the companies that lost a lot of money with this brouhaha in the markets. So that it was voted on that it's going to happen, but apparently the developers, I don't know how viable they are at this point.
Well, can you fill us in on that? There are a lot of people probably don't even know about the project.
Yeah, no, this project is amazing because it goes back to the date of Moses, you know, when chunks of land were
Robert Moses. Not the parting of the Red Sea.
No. Well, when big chunks of land were given away to one developer, and this to me is a very good example of, you know, of how this Latinization of cities, which is another spin, you know, that cities are becoming Latinized. And that to me is the biggest spin that's built on thin air because Latinos, you know, are growing in cities, but as we know, they're going to the suburbs because they're not, their communities are being gentrified. And this is one instance where a big, one of the largest developer, like two avenues length and three streets, and we're talking about a huge chunk. I mean, imagine almost anywhere from Union Square to NYU, I mean, big chunk of land given to one developer that will never fly below 125th Street, right, because it's too valuable. But in Uptown New York, right, it's that giving that much land to one developer was not seen like that. And that's why people were so angry about that project, which actually was approved against community protest.
So it's kind of like an Uptown Atlantic Yards situation.
It's one of these mega projects that we're seeing developing the entire city.
But the economy has slowed it down, so your objections don't really matter as much as they might have otherwise.
Well, they matter insofar as they show how a community, you know, how community processes of planning, you know, become, and I actually argue that the community consultation project be seen as a marketing ploy rather than as a community consultation
Well, let's talk about the Hispanic consumer. You say the Latino community is seen as a booming and profitable market, and yet it's still stereotyped as being a burden to the nation's economic welfare. How can those two things coexist?
They coexist because they reinforce each other absolutely, and they totally reinforce each other. And I'm going back to the cover of that of the book. Actually, that was a cover from the Business Week feature. It's a cover. On the one side, you have the immigrant, you know, with you know, sort of jumping almost, you know, arriving here and destitute almost. And on the other, you have this kind of rosy cheek Latino carrying five shopping bags with a, you know, white paved street, and, you know, obviously, you know, rags to riches story that the community.
He's climbed over a fence on one part of his body, and the other part, he's living in the suburbs.
Exactly, and it is this kind of rags to riches stories that Business Week feature, by the way, came out in 2005 at the height of the immigration debate, and it was unbelievable how this was in the National Association of La Raza conference in Philadelphia, and they were Minutemen protesting the meetings, while at the same time you have the business community celebrating the portrayal of Latinos as this booming constituency.
A listener named Miguel has just written in, I often have this very conversation with my friends. I'm American-born Latino, and many of my friends are from Latin America. And other than language, there's very little in common regarding culture. The analogy often used is comparing France and Poland as being the same just because they're both in Europe.
Well. I think what the listener is associating, and this is done comparing the situation of Latino and Latin American with European immigrants and European situations, and I think that. And this is the argument. Well, you know, Latinos are just like, and there's so many different. What we forget is that, I mean, Juan Gonzalez has a fantastic book called Harvest of Empire, which I think is so beautiful metaphor for thinking about Latinos. Is that we may have so many differences, but there's something to be said about the common history that we share, and that's why actually it's important in the book to not only look at, you know, the destitute and the but also look at what is the fate of Latinos in corporate America, or Latinos who make it. Are they free from racism? Are they really making it? How do we begin to measure race and inequality in this country when we can no longer assume that Latinos are all the homogeneous community? How do we begin to make alliances and begin to see the commonalities between a Mexican immigrant and a Latino and a Puerto Rican who is a citizen, but also suffers from prejudice and is lagging in school? How do we begin to make those alliances? And how do we begin to, as opposed to say, oh, well, now this one made it and there's no relationship between the Latinos who are middle class and upper middle class and everybody else?
One listener is angry with me, Carmen from Brooklyn. She says, I'm offended by the fact that you dismissed New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson as not being a true Latino because he doesn't have a Latino last name. I was just making a joke. I'm sorry. There are a lot of us Hispanics from the Southwest who are proud of their non-mestizo heritage, Mexican, Spanish, Native American, white, black, and consider ourselves real Hispanics even if we don't have Spanish last names. But another listener, Lise from Edison, New Jersey, left this comment on our show page. My foreign-born Spanish-speaking parents always answered other human being on any forms that asked for racial ethnic information. I particularly dislike the word Latino, Hispanic, etc. I think it segregates people from Spanish-speaking countries into the negative image that these terms engender among people in this country.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, when we go to that, there's going to be so many different opinions. I think that, and, you know, even the category Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, if you think about, you know, Latinos in the West Coast versus in New York, how a Dominican defines Hispanic versus how a Puerto Rican defines Hispanics, I think that there's enormous terminological variation. What's important is to really look at the structural commonalities and the kind of sociological, perhaps, experiences, and I think that that's where I'm trying to sort of show that it's premature to sort of seeing Latinos coming of age right now, and that we have a lot more to do.
Well, how does this play out on Univision, for example, which addresses itself to the various Spanish-speaking communities? through cable TV?
Oh, for Univision is very good. I mean, they have a good answer. Latinos speak Spanish, and that's it. And they watch Univision. I mean, that's their definition of a Latino, right? And that's what's wonderful about, you know, contrasting viewers' opinions. We all know that it's more complex. However, in the meantime, you have major corporations like Univision reducing Latinos to Spanish-speaking Latinos who watch Univision and making millions and billions of money.
And we also have one of the most popular morning shows in New York radio is in Spanish.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So it's that. I think the media is fantastic because here on, you know, on the ground we have all of these pet peeves about speaking Spanish in public, and but you know, politicians wondering about bilingual education. Yet corporate America, you know, they know that it makes money, and they're actually very liberal in their use of Spanish. They don't have any qualms with its use.
What about the portrayal of the Latino community on in connection to immigration policies? Do all Latinos feel stigmatized by the debate? Aren't some Latinos strongly opposed to an easing of immigration restrictions?
Absolutely, they are. But
so are they seen as traitors within the larger community?
I think what's fascinating is the realization, and you saw this in the mega marchas where you saw Puerto Ricans marching with Mexicans and people across. There's absolutely, you know, Latinos are not exempt from racism and from nativism and, you know, against their fears. But as a community, there is a general understanding that whether you are fifth generation Mexican American, if you have your name, you know, Gonzalez or Rivera or whatever, people are going to say, where are you from? And you're going to suffer from racism because people are not going to see you as belonging, as wholeheartedly American. And I think it's that realization that makes most Latinos realize that the immigration debate really affects all of us, irrespective of our citizenship status.
Just one more thing. A caller points out that now that XM and Sirius have merged, they've consolidated all of their Latino programming, musical programs, so that salsa and Mexican music and any other kind of music are all on one channel now, as though any person who speaks Spanish would appreciate all of those different traditions.
That's news to me.
There's a whole book there, don't you think?
No, I think that, you know, that I have a lot of love-hate relationship with the media because I think it's really reduces Latinos to such a, you know, very marketable and commodified. At the same time, you know, they are the number one spokespeople for Latinos in this country right now because marketers know that we make money, so they're the number one advocates for Latino representation. And my criticism is that they shouldn't be our only spokespeople. We shouldn't be valuable because people can make money out of us.
Well, in that love-hate relationship with the media, I hope that we are part of the love side, Arlene.
Absolutely.
Arlene Davila, who is a professor of anthropology and American studies at New York University, her latest book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. It's published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.